As we finish up the book of Jeremiah this morning, I want to introduce you to one of the most important relationships we have as followers of Jesus. If we don't understand this relationship, we are going to have a really hard time walking with Jesus. And I want to introduce this relationship with a quick video clip from a sitcom called The Good Place, which you've probably heard me talk about at least once before. It's a fascinating show that explores themes around the afterlife, morality, philosophy, what it means to be a good person, what it means to live a good life. It explores quite a bit of ground for a network sitcom. But in this clip, you are going to see Eleanor, who's just arrived in the Good Place, and she is talking with Michael, who is the architect of the Good Place, and she asks the question, who got it right? So let's watch that clip.
So who was right? I mean, about all of this?
Well, let's see. Hindus are a little bit right. Muslims a little bit. Jews, Christians, Buddhists. Every religion guessed about 5%, except for Doug Forsett.
Who's Doug Forsett?
Well, Doug was a stoner kid who lived in Calgary during the 1970s. One night he got really high on mushrooms, and his best friend Randy said, hey, what do you think happens after we die? And Doug just launched into this long monologue where he got like 92% correct. I mean, we couldn't believe what we were hearing. That's him, actually, right up there. He's pretty famous around here. I'm very lucky to have that.
That's it. That clip. I hope it changed your life. Just kidding. There are two things, though, that I hope you heard in that clip. Michael says all religions guessed about 5%. And then he tells the story of Doug Forsett, who with the help of some hallucinogenic drugs gets it about 92% correct. One of the reasons that I find this show so compelling is that it was created by a guy who you can hear in interviews talk about this, is completely agnostic about the possibility of God existing, about the possibility of an afterlife, which means that this show is a constant window into the thoughts and the beliefs of our neighbors who don't know Jesus. So when Michael says that all religions are guessing about the future, this is what our neighbors who don't know Jesus pretty much think that we're doing. That we are using our limited brains to try our best to guess at what might be coming or at what all of this means. And our neighbors believe that we've then built these elaborate religious systems around these pretty terrible guesses. Then when Michael tells the story of Doug Forsett, Michael's just retelling the story that the 1970s gave us. Right? Like, if we are only able to guess 5% because of like how little of our brains we use, then all we need are things like some really powerful drugs that open your minds, that expand your mind, and then suddenly it's possible to go from 5% to 92. This clip introduces us to one side of the relationship I was telling you about a minute ago as we started. And we'll call it reason. If you're taking notes, you might just write the word reason down, because this is going to be one of our two kind of themes through the morning. Our ability to make sense of the world, to make sense of our place in the world, this is what we call reason. And reason is a gift from God. Reason can help us make guesses about the future, help us anticipate what direction the stock market might go tomorrow, what we might need to wear because of the weather. Reason, it can be super helpful. Reason isn't just blind stabs in the dark, but educated guesses. Reason enables us to wrestle with and to explain the things that happen to us and the things that happen in us. And I think that part of what it means for us, part of what it means for every single one of us to be creatures made in the image of God, is that we are beings who can reason in a way that no other animal seems capable of. So then, if reason is one part of this relationship, what's the other part? What's the counterpart to reason? And it is revelation. And so you'll want to write revelation next to reason. Revelation, not the book of Revelation. That may be where you went. But the act of revelation. The act of revealing. Revelation is the truth about our world and about our place in it. But a truth that doesn't come from within us or even from among us, but a truth that comes from outside of us. Which means revelation doesn't simply make guesses about the future. Since it comes outside of time, it can describe the future. And revelation doesn't simply wrestle with what things mean. With an outsider's perspective, it announces what things mean. And so being made in the image of God means that we are creatures who need revelation from God to do the work that we were made to do. A fish doesn't think about what to eat. A fish doesn't need to be told to eat. A fish doesn't reason, and it doesn't need revelation. It just does what a fish does. We were made to reason, and we were made for revelation. I actually looked everywhere for, there's another clip from The Good Place, because I thought it would be awesome to have one for reason and for revelation. But I couldn't find the one that I wanted anywhere. But as the third season of the show is about to start, The Good Place has arrived at a fascinating question. So in the show, there's this group of people who are objectively bad people. They're immoral. And each of them in their own way. And here's the question that this show is asking about them. If these four people were to get a second chance at living on Earth, with a little bit of help, with a nudge from the outside, would they decide to be good? In fact, Ted Danson's character is so confident that with a little help they can change that he actually breaks the rules in the show in order to come and have a chat with Kristen Bell's character, and he gives her the direction that she needs. But the show reminds us that it's not enough for Bell's character to get outsider info, that she actually has to use her reason. She has to make sense of it. She needs both revelation from outside and reason from inside. Revelation has to be understood. We discover this the moment we start to read scripture, right? There is work to do in understanding what God's word is saying. It has to be interpreted. We have to use our God-given reason to make sense of God-given revelation, while that revelation then helps shape our use of our reason. And so it's actually amazing to me that the creator of the show, The Good Place, who openly says that he's agnostic about whether God exists and whether there's an afterlife, and yet the natural movement, the natural story that's unfolding, that he's telling, is about the possibility that human beings need some sort of input from outside of the system, outside of our lives, to make sense of our world and our place in it. Isn't that incredible? He is already starting to recognize that our resources alone aren't sufficient to answer the question, why are we here and what is this life about and what should we be doing? That we need something from outside. And so I'm convinced that this relationship between reason and revelation is one of the most important relationships that exists for us, especially if we want to walk with Jesus, because Jesus's words are revelation. Right? Jesus tells us that his kingdom is not of this world, not from this world. And so his words come to us from our Father who is in the heavens. They come from outside of creation. They speak to the Creator's purposes in creation. They offer us guidance as we listen to Jesus' words, right? We recognize guidance and instruction for how we should live within creation. And then we also hear in Jesus' words judgment. Judgment, words of critique, describing for us the broken parts of creation and where we are living out of sync with the Creator's intentions for us. But of course, Jesus doesn't speak to us like any old prophet, like the prophets we find in the First Testament, like prophets like Jeremiah. See, our conviction, the church's conviction for 2,000 years has been that Jesus himself, the very person, the very life that he lived, is an act of revelation by and from God. For 2,000 years, the church has been saying that Jesus is the clearest, fullest, most articulate revelation of God that the world has ever experienced. Because Jesus, being in very nature God, entered into our world as a human. Jesus existing outside of the creation, God's word, God's revelation, then took on flesh in order to show us God and his plan. Reason and revelation, God has given us both, one internal to us and one external. They exist in this like marriage with each other. They rely on each other. Neither exists on its own as an independent process. We need to reason and we need to receive revelation. Reason and revelation have a role to play in our everyday, ordinary lives, the small moments of every day. But reason and revelation can sometimes be most clearly seen in some of the bigger and life-altering parts of our lives, the things that we go through. Last week, I was not here because I was officiating a wedding for Ralph and Lindsay. Many of you know them. Ralph spent years in our youth group, and the two of them are here when they're in town, and they're so fun. But one of my favorite things I got to talk with them about, and that I talk about just at weddings in general and in preparation for weddings, is how there is just so much more going on at a wedding than what we can see. And what we can see is often incredible. Right, think about your experience of a wedding. Most of our wedding experiences are, we're dealing with the final product, right? With dresses and with decorations and with meals and with dances. And we often forget how much work and time and effort went on behind the scenes. So that the moment someone reveals that all of the centerpieces were handmade, Like our reason kicks in and we have this like deep appreciation for how much time was spent, the devotion, the attention to detail. And we sort of have an awe because of the revelation of what happened behind the scenes. Our reason helps us to respond in a cool way. At weddings, sorry, our reason reminds us as we sit there and we watch two people speak vows to each other that we're watching a sort of contract being made, right? Our reason goes, two people making agreements, cool, I get that. But as followers of Jesus, we come to weddings with like secret knowledge. We come to weddings with revelation in hand. See, we've been given a behind the scenes look at weddings because Jesus tells us that although two people are standing there and I can see two people making promises to each other, Jesus says that God is at work unseen, joining these two together. And so we know that something is happening beyond what we can see. We've received revelation that tells us that this is about way more than we can see, than we could even figure out on our own. Last week's wedding also reminded me of another life-altering moment. So one of Ralph's groomsmen introduced himself to me and then reminded me that we had met 10 years ago. And there was a reason why I didn't remember him. I was pretty busy at the time and pretty distracted because I was leading a memorial service for a young man named Damian Reynolds who grew up in our church, who took his life the day before he was supposed to get out of jail. Ralph's groomsman and I met there. That was my very first memorial service as a pastor. And it's one of those places where I discovered the limits of my reason, of my ability to make sense of life and the world and what was happening around me. In fact, I discovered no one had the ability to make sense of what had happened to Damian. There were no answers that reason could satisfy. And so in that moment, in that service, I leaned heavily on God's revelation. Receiving Psalm 23, I reminded a crowd of grieving people that the God who made Damian is a God who still loves Damian, a God who loves us, and a God who can be trusted, and a God who wants to comfort. When our reason completely failed us, revelation drew us into the arms of the Good Shepherd, who said, "You don't know where to find comfort, and so let me lead you." Couple more examples of how this relationship between reason and revelation is lived out. I had a fear that this was going to happen. Sean just had to go to work. But he told me I could share this. But last year sometime, Sean told me that he wanted to be better equipped to serve our guests at our breakfast, and he wanted to be better equipped to serve people in AA, a program he's been a part of for a number of years. And so he and I started meeting together on a mostly weekly basis, most Mondays, to start working through this lay ministry course that the Church of the Nazarene has created and provides for local churches. And every week, it's pretty much the same. He takes the week's lesson, he goes and he reads it and he does some research and spends some time reading scripture and praying, and he answers the questions and he writes responses, and then we meet and we process that work together. And sometimes we blow through it in 20 minutes and sometimes it's an hour and a half, and you just sort of never know. But over the last couple weeks, he and I have been digging into some solid theology, And specifically, our Wesleyan tradition, that is the larger spiritual family that the Church of the Nazarene is found in, places significant emphasis on what John Wesley referred to as the prevenient grace of God. The grace of God that goes before us. Grace that is there before we ever show up. Grace that prepares us. Grace that works on us. Grace that works in us, enabling us to come to that final moment, that place, ready to hear the good news and to respond with repentance and surrender. This is what Sean and I were chatting about. And as Sean and I were talking theology, we were kind of exploring his personal story and where God's prevenient grace might have been at work in him far before he ever decided to seek Jesus. And one of the things I noticed and I shared with him was that he has this tendency to look at some of the events of his life, events and people as obstacles to coming to faith. And so we just explored together how God might have been showing up and working around and even in some of those events and people all along the way that he thought previously were obstacles, but that God was at work preparing Sean to receive God's gift of salvation. I attempted in that moment to bring some revelation into Sean's reason. And then we met up just this last week as I was preparing for this morning. And Sean, just in passing, mentions how our last conversations had been making him rethink his entire life. Suddenly, God was not just a part of his life after salvation, but Sean could see God's involvement in his life before salvation. And so his life with God wasn't actually just about when he said yes, but way before he said yes, when God was for him, even then. I have one more sort of major life-altering event where reason and revelation play an important role. Most of you know this part of my story, but when I was in seventh grade, my parents got divorced. And much like Damien's death, my reason failed me as my parents divorced. I was, in almost every respect, too young to really understand what was happening. And in some ways, it didn't matter how many times I either cried or asked my parents why, because neither of them could explain it to me in a way that made any sense. There's a sense in which I was devastated, and I was lost, and I was confused, and I was angry. And I needed two things. I needed to grow in my ability to reason, so that I could at least begin to understand my parents and their explanations, but I needed more than that. We all need more than that. My parents' explanations were never quite enough. They didn't quite satisfy, even when I understood them. And it was only once I began to sit at the feet of Jesus, right? Learning about God's intentions for marriage, learning about God's willingness to let us walk in sin, that I began to really see where this event fit into my life, what it might mean for me as a person, the person that I was becoming, and so on. I needed both reason and I needed revelation to process that event and to begin to learn from it and grow out of it. And this all leads us into our last final chapter of Jeremiah. We are almost at the end of the sermon time, and I basically haven't said anything about our passage yet, at least not directly. And there are a couple reasons for that. Everything I've said so far, I think is a frame for understanding what's happening. But I'll describe that a little bit more. There's another reason why I haven't said much about it yet at this point. And that's, you may have recognized it. Because this is the third time we've dealt with it in worship. This passage is almost a word-for-word copy of the text in the book of Kings, which means we covered this passage 2 years ago. 2 years is a long time, though, so you can be forgiven if you forgot about it. But we actually talked quite a bit about this passage just a few weeks ago, because the book of Jeremiah covers the fall of Jerusalem twice. And then this week, with the daily worship guide, you read this passage twice. And then this morning, you heard it again. And so you can tell there's a reason for all of this hearing and rehearing. This passage must mean something. It must be important to get copied and like find a second place in the Bible. Like, how many times do you read a story in the Bible and go, there are so many details that got left out of this, but this story gets in there twice. We could have saved some space, filled in some extra details somewhere else, right? No, this story apparently needs to get heard twice. In the same way that a couple will talk about that time when they got married, or family will talk about the death of a loved one, or a Christian will tell the story of their salvation, or a person will tell the story about a traumatic family event, whether it's divorce or something else, Jeremiah 52 tells the story of the most traumatic, life-altering, world-shaking event in the life of Israel, at least in the First Testament. And we're not going to take a ton of time to dig into the details of this passage, because in some ways this is one of those passages that it just sort of works on you as a whole, as you hear it, as you experience it. The details are in some ways pretty straightforward, so that in a certain year under a certain king, verse 3 tells us, things came to the point in Jerusalem and Judah that God cast them out of his presence. Just the time has come. It got to a certain point. And God cast them out. The chapter then tells the story of Jerusalem being destroyed, Judah going into exile, and we get all of these details. As you read it this week, you might have thought, why? Right? In verse 18, we learn that the bronze pots and shovels and snuffers and basins and dishes were all taken away. Glad you know that. Verse 21, we learn that the pillars are so big that they had to be broken into pieces, because when they were together, we get the exact measurements, they were 18 cubits high and 4 fingers thick and then hollow in the middle. It's these kinds of details, though, that hopefully remind us of the temple's origins. These details connect us with the details in Exodus, the details in Kings. Those places in the story of God where the temple is being imagined and where it's designed and then it's built. And so in excruciating detail, Jeremiah 52 is telling us that all of it, every detail, every bit of it is being undone, broken and smashed and taken away. The people were devastated, and they were lost, and they were confused, and they were angry. Of course, this chapter tells us nothing about how the people felt or responded, and there's a reason for that. You flip the page, and you find yourself in Lamentations, and Lamentations definitely tells us how the people are feeling. But this chapter has another purpose. This chapter is filled with all of the stuff that people can see and touch and taste, all of the stuff that they can make sense of, that they can describe, that they can reason. See, the ancient Israelites would have read this chapter and they would have said, yep, that's what happened to us. This is our story. This is a true account. And the moment God's people acknowledge that all of this is true, that all of this has objectively happened, that Babylon came and destroyed Jerusalem and Judah and God's holy temple and sent God's holy people into exile, when the people reason that this is the truth of their lives, that everything is gone and destroyed, well, then they have to deal with the 51 chapters that came before it, that announced that it was coming. Jeremiah had announced. He'd shown up on the scene and he'd said, "I am a prophet of the God of Israel. I have been given revelation." I think most of us, if anybody stood in front of us and announced that they were a prophet with a revelation from the God of Israel, would say, "All right," and wander away. I think a lot of us have heard people announce that they have words from the Lord, announce that they have something that we should listen to, and again and again, turns out they want money, or they want to control us, or they want something. And so there's something about somebody standing in front of you announcing that they have revelation from God that is unsettling. Jeremiah announces this, that he would explain to the people what was happening to them and how they should respond. But the people in Jeremiah's time, they use their reason to deny Jeremiah's revelation. Revelation is rejected over reason. And we discover that actually the people weren't opposed to revelation, so to speak. They were simply against revelation that didn't make sense in light of their reason. And so in their world, they believed that God was pleased with them. In their world, they believed that God would never allow Jerusalem to be destroyed. In their world, and the way they imagined who their God was and what he was doing, they could not fathom the possibility that God would let his temple be destroyed. But then he did. Because of the timing of it, there's a lot of factors. We know that the last chapter of Jeremiah wasn't written by Jeremiah, but was stuck on at the end of Jeremiah's collected sermons and prayers and activities. And the church has declared that this chapter, as much as the 51 before it are God-breathed, but that this chapter is God's way of vindicating Jeremiah. Chapter 52 announces for all of the world, "Hey, everyone who has ever listened to Jeremiah and doubted him, Jeremiah was right." He was right. Accept it. Will you? He was right. 51 chapters. Read this. This is what happened. He said it was going to happen, and it did. Jeremiah ought to be trusted. And so here's what the people of God were to do. With chapter 52, this unavoidable evidence that God had spoken through Jeremiah, the people needed to then go back. And they needed to let their reason be reshaped by God's revelation through Jeremiah. Right? Everything that Jeremiah announced that they thought was impossible, now, in light of Jerusalem's destruction, in light of the impossible happening, they needed to go back and completely reconsider. They needed to reconsider their lives before God. They had thought they couldn't be sinners. They weren't sinners. That was impossible. Turns out it was very possible. They needed to reconsider the character of God. They believed that God would never destroy a thing that he had put his name on, and then he did. They needed to reconsider their relationship with God. They needed to reconsider God's relationship with the world. But also now, they needed to reconsider the actual event that was making them reconsider everything else. See, because in almost every way, the exile of God's people from the land was experienced as the end. If you read Lamentations, you get this sense, this groaning, this deep, like, cry that has a sense that we have been utterly abandoned, that God is done with us, that he has taken away everything, and we are over, that this is our end. I don't know if you've ever experienced tragedy, but when a spouse or a child dies, when a relationship ends, when war destroys your home, when you're fired, when, right, fill in the blank, you know how these feel. They feel so powerful. They feel so final. They feel like the end, don't they? And our reason often keeps us locked into a narrow perspective that this event is the ultimate event, that this event is of utmost value and importance and meaning in our lives. And so we have to find somebody to blame to make sense of this event. We have to deny that this bad thing ever happened, pretending, like, imagining that's the only way to move on. We have to explain it somehow. But Revelation enters into our tragedy. And it reminds us that sin and death and exile and judgment never have the final word. When you read Jeremiah and you hear God speaking through Jeremiah, you read 52 and you declare, this is not the end. You know it's not the end if you have ears to hear what Jeremiah has been saying from the beginning. But if you're operating out of reason, sin and death and loss and exile and judgment, they always feel like the end. But Revelation reminds us that none of these things have the final word. Part of why we can be a people with hope is that God is able to undo every one of these things. God is able to eliminate sin from his creation. God is able to raise the dead. God is able to bring back people who have been exiled, and God is able to restore those who have been judged. These are God's final words. And so you can imagine, as the Israelites began in exile to work back through Jeremiah, not only would they hear that, man, Jeremiah was right all along, we should have listened to him, but they would also hear promises of an impossible future. If you don't think it's impossible, spend some time exploring history and ask yourself how many times a group of people have been utterly removed from some place that they existed and then somehow restored to it. It's mostly impossible. From a historical perspective. But God was announcing that he would restore his people, that he would bring them back into the land. He was announcing that he would change their hearts. That might be the more impossible thing. All of this, as impossible as it originally seemed that God would send people into exile in the first place, now the people are learning to trust Jeremiah as a source of true revelation. And so now maybe they will trust his promises for the future. They will trust his judgments about their sin and idolatry. See, Revelation is establishing a trustworthy historical record so that we can reason that the God who keeps revealing himself as trustworthy can continue to be trusted into the future. So that when this God speaks meaning into our tragedy and into our lives, when this God speaks to us about our future, we might trust him and obey his words of revelation. We hear all of this going on in Jeremiah, but then we see it again in the life, in the death, and the resurrection of Jesus. We hear Jesus say, I will die, and on the third day I will be raised. And he's killed. And how do people experience his death? As the end. That's the end. This whole thing that we've been about for years, it's over. This is the end. And then every word that Jesus spoke is vindicated when God raises him from the dead. And so once again, we have this evidence, this act of God showing that the impossible is possible when he promises it. And so we can trust and abide in his words deeply, and we can walk with him, and we can know his words are good, and that he is good, and that he is for us and with us, and that all of the things that he has promised will come to be. We're going to gather around the table, and we're reminded in Paul's words that he says in 1 Corinthians, every time we eat the bread and we drink the cup, we proclaim the Lord's death until he returns. And so in many ways, you see how this table meets us in our reason and invites us to receive revelation once more, to receive the revelation that Christ died for us. And in God raising him from the dead, we can have great and abiding hope that he will return, that he will establish his kingdom, that all things will be made new. And so right here in the middle, we keep seeking him and walking with him. And as we come to the table this morning, Jane said it earlier, we trust in his promise that where two or more are gathered in his name, there he is. I don't know this morning if you came in here expecting to participate in something that you might watch or listen to or just sort of be a part of or what. Or if you came in here convinced of that promise that where two or more are gathered in his name, there he is. That in our gathering this morning, we have deliberately sought to be in the presence of God in some profoundly beautiful way. And as we gather around his table, we are actually joining with Jesus at his table, that he joins us to share a meal with us, to remind us that we are part of his family, that we've been invited into this life of love and this life of trust. And so, friends, this morning, we respond to that invitation, and I hope that you hear the Jesus who is here present with us inviting you to come and to, I don't know why this is the only word I can think when I think about this, sup with him. I don't know, where does sup come from? But dine, that doesn't feel right. Eat, I guess that works. Share a meal with him. eat, that works. But he's inviting us this morning to come, to trust him, and to walk with him.